This episode is sponsored by Midlock Investment Partners, the real estate investment firm, operator, and fund manager. Midlock invests in middle market properties valued between $5 and $50 million in the Midwest and beyond, using a value-add strategy. Learn more about Midlock and join their mailing list at midlock.com. That's Midlock, M-I-D-L-O-C-H.com. Thanks, Midlock, for being a sponsor of Passive Investing from Left Field.
So normally you think of a recession when you're overheated. We're still an underheated economy. We're not an overheated economy. That's why this notion you hear the soft landing. The plane is coming in from below the runway. It's not coming in from above. The soft landing is the, you know, it's above sustainable. And as you try to slow it, does it crash? We're still trying to get back to the runway.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
This is Brian Burke from Praxis Capital, and you are listening to the Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast.
I'm really excited and honored today to have Peter Linneman with us again. He holds both master's and doctorate degrees in economics from the University of Chicago, and was a professor of real estate at the Wharton School of Business. He's a principal of Linneman Associates, where he provides strategic and M&A analysis, market studies, and feasibility analysis to a number of leading U.S. international companies. He is an accomplished author, having written books, articles, and, of course, the Linneman Letter, a quarterly letter for commercial real estate investors. He was also a guest in July of 2023, and we split it into two episodes, episodes 123 and 124, Passive Investing from Left Field. So, Peter, welcome to the Past Investing from Left Field podcast.
Nice to be here, and it's good to have spring happening in Philadelphia.
Well, it's also happening in Columbus, so I'm right there with you. The way we usually start out is just your journey. Now, I'm going to direct people to episodes 123 if they want to review the whole journey, but can you just give us the recap of kind of how you got into real estate and how you became such an expert in economics?
Well, I'll take the first one first, the second one first. I majored in economics as an undergrad. I came from a blue-collar family, knew nothing, went to college, stumbled onto an amazing professor who I was just talking to. She's 102 now. And that was, I met her in 1969, just so if anyone wants to do the math. She was very inspirational and a great economics professor, and said to me, you should go to the University of Chicago and study with Milton Friedman and George Stigler and Gary Becker, which I did. And I wish I could say I learned as much as they knew, but I learned as much as I could learn in economics, and then embarked on a career in economics. And in the early years, I was doing industrial analysis, labor market analysis, a lot of applied statistical work, et cetera. And in 1985, the dean at Wharton, which I was at that time, came and said, we've got this real estate program, and I either am going to kill it or grow it, and I don't know which. Would you just take a look? And I had nothing to do with it. I was not doing any of that, and I knew it was disgraceful that a place like Wharton had such a program. And as Al Taubman subsequently said, the great Al Taubman, it was like having a flea market at 56th and 5th, you know, in Manhattan. He asked after I said, yeah, I said, yes, it's an industry that needs professionalization. That was a long time ago, 85, almost 40 years ago. Very little professionalism, very little knowledge. It's all about over-borrowing and tax gimmicks. But that's going to change, and the industry needs to change. And so I said, well, why don't you do it? I said, I don't know anything about it. He said, you're smart. You'll learn. Well, he was at least pretty accurate about the I'll learn. I don't know if he was accurate about the smart. And I went to school, so to speak, on anything I could find or read. which wasn't much because it was very underprofessional. A lot of how to get rich in, you know, 24 hours with real estate kind of books back then. But I had some very wonderful teachers like Al Taubman and Mel Simon and Mort Zuckerman and all these legendaries that were a generation ahead of me wanted to see the industry professionalized. And so I started really, I was their student and I ate it up. And then we built a program about what they taught us, taught me, and we implemented a program and then kept learning. And my advisory business was started in 1979. And by 1990, it was pretty much real estate focused. It wasn't real estate focused. And if you think about what I was saying, studying industry, studying labor markets, studying capital markets, et cetera, all kind of came together in that real estate brings a lot of that together along with the economics. And so it's been a long journey. It's been a long journey. But it's been a great journey, and I've met some amazing people, just staggering people, and I've learned so much from them.
Well, that's great. And, you know, like I said, the last episode, I learned so much from that. I'm super excited just to dive into the content. And in that last conversation, and again, this was July of 2023, when it was released. So we probably had the conversation in June. But you had said the biggest challenge at the time facing the economy was the Fed's belief that they had to create a recession to improve things. So are they still trying to do that, or are we beyond that?
I think they're still trying to do it. They're confused. I said back then it was a crazy concept. We're still below. We were very below sort of trend GDP, if you will, back then. We still are below trend. It's a very misguided effort. They're punishing anybody who uses short-term money needlessly. Now, that's not to say the rate should have been zero. That was just as silly, right? So, but somewhere between 0 and 5.5% is a number. And it feels to me somewhere in the middle is about where it should be. The thing that's important, Jim, is to understand, contrary to your macroeconomics class, which we all sat there and said, oh, this is wonderful. I didn't have that at Chicago. We didn't do that. But ask yourself, how much of the economy is really sensitive to short-term interest rates? Let's take it in parts. Are the state, local, and federal governments very sensitive to interest rate movements on the short end? Not really. They're going to hire and grow and build bridges and transfer money no matter what. They've done it with high interest rates. They've done it with low interest rates all through history, right? So, okay, there's 35% of the economy not interest rate sensitive. Now let's go, suppose you had a heart attack right now, heaven forbid. Are you going to say, nope, don't call emergency until Powell cuts the interest rate to 4%? No. And the healthcare sector, a woman about to deliver a baby isn't going to say, no, not until Powell cuts the interest rate. Little Johnny's going to stay in for another, 12 months. Well, there's 18% of the economy that's healthcare. You're going to take your prescription drugs. You're going to do whatever. You're going to get if you've got glaucoma, you're going to get it dealt with. If you've got cataracts, you're going to get it dealt with. So now we're at 53% of the economy. Now let's do education. Are you going to say, nope, sorry, Belinda, can't go to school today. The interest rate's too high. You know, I hope you'll enjoy staying home during the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. That's not going to happen. Well, now you're up to 60%. We're not even trying yet, right? And when you go through all that, you end up with about 20% of the economy is somewhat or a lot sensitive to short-term interest rates. So when you think about it, you're trying to slow an economy that's way below trend, pent-up medical care demand, pent-up travel demand, pent-up auto demand, etc. That's trying to catch up to trend GDP. Just normal, right? It's just normal. And at the same time, the Fed's trying to stop the train by pulling on one car, you know, and it's too powerful a train. That's why the economy keeps growing, is that pent up demand due to being below trend is offsetting the punishing of the 20% with high interest rates. And you and I know, for example, what's a good sector? Development, right? You're doing short rate money and you're getting clobbered on it. But they're not the only ones. Corporate manufacturing companies with lines of credit on receivables and inventory, et cetera. But remember, a lot of consumers, for example, and the consumer is the main part of the economy, they don't even borrow. So how does a higher interest rate slow them at all?
Well, so then we hear a lot of talk about the Fed, right? And that they look at the CPI and they look at the PCE, which is the personal consumption expenditure, I think. And
right.
Can you explain the difference when and why the Fed's looking at both of them and they have different components that goes into each of them? So it seems like they're in conflict sometimes.
Well, let me give you a description and then I'll tell you what they really say, okay?
Perfect.
The biggest difference, basically the way to think about it, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, not the Fed. The Bureau of Labor Statistics goes out and surveys about 75,000 goods and services that consumers consume every month, okay? And they weight them up. You know, Coca-Cola is up by one penny and M&M's is down, and they weight all that up, 75,000 items. I think in 75 metropolitan areas, they do that. It's a lot of work. And they do it with care. And they come back with the average last month was and the average this month. And obviously, you're not going to weight an M&M's the same as you do autos, right? Because autos are bigger. So they weight them up. The wild card in these indexes is housing, okay? CPI assigns about 36% to that price of housing. Okay, so M&M's is down at almost nothing, and CPI gives 36%, I'm rounding, to housing. PCE gives about 18% to housing. And of course, that simply means all those other items get the 18% spread across them. That's the way to think about it. Now, the second nuance is that all of the 75,000 items they collect are for last month versus the month before. But one item, housing, basically reflects 7 months earlier. Now, there's a long reason why. It's kind of a dumb reason for this purpose. But 7 months earlier, okay? Second part of that is, are you a homeowner, Jim? How much did your rent go up in the last 6 months? Not at all. And by the way, I could go to owner after owner after owner after owner, and they'll all say the same thing, except somebody will say, I had to repair a gutter spout, and that was a little more expensive than last time I did it, and I had to repair a broken window or a faucet, right? But you paid no rent. They assume you pay rent when you don't. So two-thirds of the households are having no rent increases, and they're pretending they do, and they're pretending they do. This is oversimplified, but think of it this way. Imagine you need a 5% rate of return as a landlord, okay? And your neighbor comes and says, I'll rent your home. And you'll say, fine, you have to cover all my costs and give me a 5% return on the value of the home. If you rent from me, okay? What happens to, quote, that rent when the home price goes up in value? Well, the rent goes up in value, just mechanically, right? So even though two-thirds of the households are not getting any rent increase, the general increase in home prices is saying they're paying higher rent to the tune of about 6% per annum. And you go, but by the way, you haven't had any other than your gutter spout, okay? Let's go to the one-third that do rent. You're in the business. What's happened to apartment rents in the last 5-6 months? Flat, 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 flat. I don't care what market you go to. It's flat, 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 negative in some cases, positive in the other, okay? They're showing 6%. Why? They're looking back 6, 7, and 8 months. And you go, so here we have an index that's crazy when it comes to an item that's 36% of the index. But it's just crazy because we know 2/3 of the households have zero rent increases. And the other third has had no rent increase for 5 months, right? So what would you say has been housing inflation over the last 5 or 6 months? And the answer is zero, for real. Okay. They're saying 6%. Okay. On an annual basis. Now that's kind of odd. So let me tell you about PCE and CPI. CPI, I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I may be off. If you go from August, this is their data. If you go from August to February, they show an annualized inflation rate that's like 2.9%. But if you say really housing was zero, it's 1.1%. Okay. For the last 6 months, 7 months, it's zero. Excuse me, 1.1%. PCE gives a lower weight to housing. And since August through January, the February data is not out, it shows 2.1%. And when you say housing has been zero over that time period, it's 1.2%. Gee, what do you think inflation really has been since August? And you say, are you cherry picking with August? Yes, intentionally. I want to know what's been happening recently, not a year ago. And what happened was things flattened out. They were rising for everything, and then they all flattened out because supply came back for everything. And that's why rents aren't rising, right? Supply came back. So for real, we have probably 1% inflation. For real. They're acting as if we have 2.5% to 3% inflation. Don't know why. Nothing I just said is that complicated.
And certainly they have that information, right? I mean, the people at the Fed, they know what you know, right? What you just explained.
We would hope.
We would hope. So I guess the question is, you know, what next? Like if inflation has reached the targets that the Fed wants, which is 2%-ish, right? Then what are they going to do going forward? Because everyone was talking about, you know, a few months ago, they were going to get 5, 6, 7 rate decreases. You know, I think you said I listened to the Walker webcast in January, you thought there was going to be 5 rate cuts. So, but now it seems to have changed that they're talking about maybe no rate cuts. So where do you land on that?
Well, common sense says it should be around 3% right now. How they get to 3, I think they're going to cut a quarter. They could even do it next month. They've got to realize this, and they're going to get shocked. Because remember I told you the housing data lags? That housing data lagging is going to really pull it down in a few months, right? It's just mathematical. And remember when the Fed, they said they weren't going to raise rates? And then 2 months later, they had the fastest rate increase ever? That's the spirit of what's going to happen. They're going to go slow, and then they're going to say, oh my God, we're terrified of deflation. And they're going to, if they have any intelligence at all, whether it's 5 cuts or 3 cuts, they're going to cut it 150 basis points this year if they have a brain, and probably more. It's just common sense. If inflation is 1 to 2% for real, why do you have a 5.5% interest rate? I mean, that makes no sense. It says I can just sit on cash and get a 4.5% return taking no risk. That's insane that you should get a 4.5% return taking no risk, a real return, right? Taking no risk.
Yeah, so what was the real cause of inflation? We talked about this a little bit last time, but you know, there are the shortages from closing down the economy, and then some of that supply is coming back online, as you said, from the pandemic. There were government payments to people during the pandemic, and the super low interest rates. mean, did all of that cause it? Was it some of it? And you know, what's going to, and he said it's already down to where it needs to be, right? So I'm not sure I understand what the issue is.
So I think the thing I like to remind people is 4 years ago, just flashback 4 years ago, was the most extraordinary event in my lifetime. I wasn't alive during World War II, right? But it's the most extraordinary event. You couldn't go to work, couldn't go to the shopping center. You had, by early April, we had a negative price of oil. You couldn't buy a car. That was odd, right? It was really odd. I'm not saying bad or good. It just was. And we forget. That wasn't in any economics book. And they're trying to manage this as if it was. Like, you know, this is just a normal. It's not normal. This is the most extraordinary. We had 23% of the labor force collecting unemployment insurance just over 4 years ago. So, you know, it 4 years ago in April and May last year. And that's unnormal. All of what's happened is a reaction to that. Demand shut down, supply shut down. Demand came back. That created huge profits because prices went up because across the board in the economy, demand exceeded supply. And, apartments were a classic example, but it was true for everything. That caused a lot of inflation. Low rates fed it, but remember, not most of the economy is sensitive to short-term rates. But it did feed it on the 20% that was sensitive to short-term rates to have low rates. The stimulus had an effect, but not what people say. About $4 out of every $5 that went in, we saved. So the way to think about what really happened was we had no idea what was going to happen 4 years ago, almost literally 4 years ago, right? We had no idea what was going to happen. We said we're a really rich country. Jim can't borrow. Peter can't borrow. By the way, they're all losing their jobs as we speak. And what we're going to do is instead of Jim borrowing and Peter, we're going to have the federal government borrow for them because the federal government could. And we borrowed from our future. And we kept $4 out of every $5 we borrowed from our future. So it'd be like if you went to a bank and you borrowed $5, but you kept four of them in the bank, did you really borrow $5, right? Especially when the interest rate was low, did you really? And that's kind of what we did, whether it was businesses or or individuals. So it fed it a bit, but the big thing was supply, just supply, supply, supply. And as supply came back and it came back faster and stronger in the U.S. than anywhere else for one simple reason. We respond more to profits than any other economy of any size in the world. And when prices went up, remember, a lot of countries were not allowing prices to go up. We allowed prices to go up. That created big profits, which created a big incentive to bring on supply. And then you saw everybody bringing on supply across the board for almost everything, and guess what happened? You went from a negative oil price to the price goes up to $100 a barrel. You can go to sector after sector. You get apartment rents jumping by 12% in like 6 months. Then what happened? As supply came back, you started seeing those factors disappear, some still existing a bit, some undershooting. So it's a little bit the interest rate, but remember that's only 20% of the economy in effects. And it's a bit of the stimulus, there's no doubt. But it's mostly simply we shut down the economy, and when supply caught up with demand, prices stopped rising.
But how do you look at that then when we had this, a bull run in most all assets, right, from I don't know when in the mid-2010s, right, until the pandemic hit, then you had this big bottom and then it spiked back up. So are cycles gone that are economic, not black swan type cycles? And so it just seems like if you kind of take out the pandemic, which I know you can't really, it just seems like,
right?
you're just going up, right? You just continue to go up.
Right. So I think my read of the pandemic, but remember, none of these models are relevant in a way, because nobody has a model for you shut the economy down, right? And therefore, we have no insight other than intuition on what happens when it comes back. Right? Yet, I say they pretend. One of the things shutting down the economy did was it got rid of a lot of weak businesses. It was like, nope, can't make it, right? I just can't make it. And so it actually cleansed. I'm not saying it's an optimal way to cleanse the system, but it did cleanse excesses that might have been building up 2017, 18, 19. It cleansed. You saw it in retail. You saw all the companies that were going to go bankrupt as retailers in 2020, 21, and 22 all go bankrupt in 2020, right? I mean, that's what it did to the system. And as a result, we had a recession, a very deep one, right? When you look at the data, but people don't think of it that way. So would we have had, let's suppose we had never had the pandemic, things would have gone, we would have probably had a recession by 2022. Not a horrible one, but excesses build up. We do stupid things. You know, we get too impressed with ourselves. We get ahead of ourselves, just like always. That's not happening. Because it wiped out all that, and we're trying to catch up. We're desperately trying to catch up. And not just catch up in an odd way. We're trying to catch up with, and I'll take, you know, I'll be 73 in a week. Cataracts. You know, I couldn't go get cataracts done. We're trying to catch up with hip replacements. We're trying to catch up with vacations. We're trying to catch up with cars. We couldn't get cars. We couldn't go out and buy them. Then, just when we could go out and buy them, they didn't have enough of them because they couldn't get components. And then just as they got components, they raised the interest rate. So the 2/3 of consumers that borrow to buy a car are going, well, I can't. So it's still pent up. So we still have probably 1.5% of GDP to catch up. So normally you think of a recession when you're overheated. We're still an underheated economy. We're not an overheated economy. That's why this notion you hear the soft landing. The plane is coming in from below the runway. It's not coming in from above. The soft landing is the, you know, it's above sustainable. And as you try to slow it, does it crash? We're still trying to get back to the runway. It's like we have the plane in an underground hangar, and we're trying to move the plane from the underground hangar up to the runway. The plane's not even on the runway yet. How's it crash?
Rustle Capital is a lean Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Rustle Capital. In their approach to managing risk, in locations they invest, product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Rust Belt Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journey. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com.
Let's talk about unemployment, right? Because it seems like the Fed, in our last conversation also, we talked about that, is focused on, you know, driving up unemployment to get to their numbers. And there's a lot of stuff going on there, depending on who you listen to, right? It seems like, you know, there's a lot of part-time jobs. So some people get counted twice, even though they have two jobs, and that gets counted as two people. And so how does all that work, and how's the Fed looking at it? And are they just waiting to drive more people out of jobs so we can reset after that?
So there, first of all, the part-time point people make, that's always been true. That's not new. That's always been true. There have always been part-time people. There's always people who have a full-time job and a part-time job. There's always been people who have three part-time jobs. That's not new. That's always been in the data. Is there more of it now than then? Not particularly. There's certainly more of it now than 3 years ago. But versus 2019, not really. 2018, not really. We always had the issue you said. Now, there are two surveys done by the government. Not again, not by the Fed. Two surveys done. One is of employers. And the employers is the one, I could go to you and you say, yeah, Peter works for me. And I go to another company and they say, yeah, Peter works for me. And I count two jobs. Okay. And I count as getting a second job looks like getting a first job. Okay. And that's the payroll data, so-called payroll data. And that's, I don't know, I'm doing from memory, 70,000 firms, something like that. They survey 80,000 firms. The other is a survey of human beings, and that's a survey of about 65,000 households, and they ask a real simple question, are you working? And if not, are you looking for work? It's that simple. And you say, well, it's got to be a more sophisticated question. Nope. It's those two questions. Are you working? And you either say yes, in which case you're counted as employed. Now, by the way, if you have eight jobs, what are you going to answer when the question is, are you working? Yes. Right? If you have one job, you're going to say yes. If you have no, you'll say no. Then they take the people who say no, just think of a questionnaire. If you're not working, are you actively looking for work? And if you say yes, you're considered unemployed. If you say no, you're not considered unemployed, even though you are. Okay? So, one of the things that's happened in this recovery is that the loss of jobs was so extensive that we just kept getting people coming back who were saying, no, I'm not actively looking for work. So just think of the reality of what we lived through. Don't think of a model. Just think of the reality. Everybody lost their job. We kept them on assistance where a lot of them got paid more not to work than work. Were they actively looking for employment? Nope. But wages were also rising quite rapidly. And your brother down at the company says, oh, they're hiring and they're talking about, and the wage is up $3 an hour. And by the way, the government assistance is going to go away shortly. So last month you said you weren't looking. You may have said 6 hours ago you weren't looking. But if it landed in your lap, you took it. And so you had a lot of people who were, I think, legitimately saying, they're not looking. I'm having a good time, but wow, at that wage, I'll come back in. So you had effectively a lot of non-looking people taking jobs. And that's how the economy has built back its capital, or its human capital.
And so do you think the Fed is still trying to get to that 5% unemployment? Because I think it's lower now, according to their measure. So is that something they're going to keep pushing for, or does it matter?
I think they've realized, who knows? I think they've realized that they're kind of pushing against a string a bit. They're chasing a ghost. I'm not sure they understand why they're chasing a ghost. Namely, this pent-up demand, we already flushed the recession, we're below trend, etc. All this pent-up demand, a lot of the economy isn't interest rate sensitive. I think they've now gotten kind of mostly focused on inflation, mostly just mechanically on inflation. Because what they've found is they've raised rates and the economy keeps growing. And that's because of pent-up demand way offsets the 20% reacting to higher rates. So they're creating a lot of distortions, which is hurting the economy. But, you know, they've always been late. They've always overreacted. As long as I you know, I remember 1973, I think I said it last time, Milton Friedman saying the Fed is always arrogant, they're always late, they always overreact, and they always think they have a much more control and insightful position than they do. I've seen nothing over the subsequent 51 years to change that view.
Yeah. So, you know, if we look at the standard things that, you know, the most people are looking at as far as, you know, the stock market, gold, Bitcoin, all that stuff is at or near all-time highs right now. So, I don't even know what the question is. Why is that when it seems like, you know, the Fed and others and even in people, right, that in the world or in the U.S. think that the economy's having trouble, but you look at some of these standard measures that people look at and everything's just up, 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 maybe not real estate, but everything else.
Yeah, I was going to say, ask some of the office owners if everything's up, 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 right?
Right, exactly.
I'm not being cute, but yes, you know what I'm saying. Look, there's a lot of money in the system. There's just a lot of money in the system, and money drives pricing, right? And it drives asset pricing. And there's still a lot of money in the system. And is the market ever right? Of course not. But where else are you going to go with your money? Now, right now, a lot of people are just sitting in cash accounts getting 5.5%. And taking no risk, but they're not going to do that forever. And when the interest rates come down, you'll probably see them move into more risk assets, not all, but more into risk assets rather than cash accounts. The other thing is the U.S. economy, put aside what we just went through in the pandemic, the U.S. economy always has huge problems, always. Terrible public education system, you know, bad politics, venal politicians, dishonest businesses, bad judges, you know, just go through it all, right? And yet we grow because the entrepreneurship, the stability of the system just overwhelms all that, And it has and will. And I think people kind of understand don't bet against the U.S. economy long term. Bet against it short term, but don't bet against it long term. And that's what powers the economy ultimately. It's entrepreneurship, it's risk taking, it's, you know, it's access to relatively cheap energy, you know, on and on. And I mean, am I optimistic about the economy? Yeah. But do I think the economy has huge problems? Yeah. You know, it's like, not to make a farce of this, but for a 72-year-old, I'm pretty damn good. On the other hand, you want to hear about this or that or the other, right? Well, you're 72, right? The economy is always, and I said at a speech one time, all of my adult life, you could list all kinds of reasons the economy's in trouble. And there are real reasons. You know, we're spending too much government money. We have bad trade policies. We have bad tax policies. We have bad politicians. We have terrible public education system. The private education system is not that good. Our universities are crap. And yet we grow. And that, by the way, if we had none of those problems, would we grow more? Yeah. But come on, that's asking for too much.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to be respectful of your time. This has been awesome, fascinating, great stuff. Again, if people want to learn more about you or find where the Lineman letter is, how could they do that?
Easiest way is to go to Lineman Associates, and you'll find out about the wonder of me and mine. And that ranges from Lineman letter and our books, and the charitable work we do through Save a Mind, some, for example, we'll post this there. So, you know, there's a library of things I've done that they can get, and, you know, they can get the wonder of me. Well, awesome. What greater weekend gift can you give yourself?
Well, hey, I love listening to you talk. You got great information, and we really appreciate you being on the show. We look forward to the next time. So thank you so much, Peter. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Visor provides investors with a secure platform that displays a comprehensive view of all of their holdings on a single, holistic dashboard. From real estate syndications to private equity, crypto to traditional investments, with AI-driven, unbiased, honest insights to maximize return, Visor is your one place to rule them all. Automating performance tracking, projecting future cash flow, analyzing all your financial documents, and much more in one powerful solution, making it easy to follow the money. Sign up for a free 30-day trial now at Visor.co. Investing in syndications can be a daunting task. Wiring a large sum of your hard-earned money to someone you talk to on the phone for 30 minutes can certainly be scary. How can you be confident in what you're doing? Steve Sue, one of the founders of LFI, just published a book called Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Field Investor. 20 lessons learned from 14 years of investing in private syndications. This is by far the best book I've read on syndication investing. It's an easy-to-read book, chock full of great advice from Steve's experience as a passive investor. It is a must-read. Whether you're a first-time passive investor or a veteran, go to www.leftfieldinvestors.com/books and click on the link to Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Field Investor. If you are a passive investor, you got to read this book.
That was another just great chat with Peter. I'm so grateful to him for coming on our show and just sharing his knowledge. He's been doing this for a long time. And as he mentioned in the open, he has been taught by some of the great economists, and he himself is just an outstanding economist and just has great information and digs deep into it. One of the things I was really glad he talked about is how the economy is affected by interest rates, right? And he boiled it down. Only 20% really of the economy is affected by the low interest rates, high interest rates. Now, it might have an outsized impact when you look at real estate and some of the things that we focus on, for sure. When you're looking at the general economy, the impact isn't as great as it might seem. And so we need to factor that in when we're evaluating things. And then he really dug into the CPI and the PCE, which, you know, I was thankful for, because the PCE, it's the personal consumption expenditure, and it's a little bit different than the CPI, and how they handle housing was really interesting. And Peter would say that, you know, our real inflation rate right now is below 2, which is the Fed target. It's 1.5, based on the lag from housing. And so it could be that in 4 months or 6 months or whenever the lag catches up, and, you know, that the lack of inflation in housing, it catches up, that the real inflation will be shown to be what it actually is right now. And because of that lag, then the Fed might end up overreacting. And sure, there is a lot of inflation in housing if you are going to buy a new home, because, you know, the same priced home that you might have bought 3 years ago now is going to cost you double as far as your mortgage payment because of the spike in interest rates. But that's a small portion of people. Most people aren't moving right now. Most rents are going down or flat, as he said. And most homeowners are sitting on their mortgages from long ago that, you know, have really good interest rates. So very interesting that the Fed, their focus is totally on inflation. But as Peter says, they're missing some stuff because of the lag in just the housing. Everything else, from what Peter was saying, is current, right? They look at all these current items month to month, but then housing has this huge lag, which really causes a mismatch in data. So it'll be really interesting to see in 4, 5, or 6 months and revisit with Peter and see, was he right? Did the government reported inflation numbers really come down because of this lag that will finally catch up? And then he talks about the economy, you know, why is it growing? Well, it's pent-up demand. Humans, I think, forget bad stuff pretty quickly, right? So 4 years ago, we were in this pandemic, and, you know, it's March 15th today when we're recording this. So we were one day away from at least Ohio shutting down, and the entire economy shut down. It's a big world economy. So to think that it might take 3-4 years before we kind of get some of that out of our system. That makes sense to me. So, you know, Peter's optimistic, but he always has been. He says there's bad things in the economy, there's good things in the economy, and the U.S. economy tends to be resilient. So for real estate investors, yeah, we have a couple of tough years here. There's some capital calls coming. There's some loss of equity in some deals. There's distributions that are paused. But overall, the economy is doing well, and that's why it makes sense to have diversification, you know, from asset classes and all the things that we generally talk about. But really appreciate Peter coming on the show. Just a great guest. I really want to see if we can check in with him again in 6 to 9 months and see where we're at in the economy. This is one of those episodes, I've been saying this a lot lately, but this is one of those episodes where I'll listen to it several times because there's so many nuggets in there. So hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next time in the left field.
Thanks for hanging out in the left field with us today. If you're interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the podcast would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.